Did you see the stylish kids in the riot? Shoveled up like monks at the night on fire, wombles bleed, truncheons and shields. You know I cherish you, my love.
Welcome to the Young IPA Podcast. I'm James, this is Pete.
G'day.
It is the 25th of January. This is episode 44. Nina, thank you so much for being here.
No problem.
She has to be here.
She has to be here, contractually obliged. But yeah, pretty cool, you know, a bit different with this podcast. It's coming out on a Thursday instead of a Friday.
6-day turnaround.
Yeah. So, you know, if it's bad, we get to say, well, our energy was thrown off. Yeah, we were still playing from last week's
AFL
injuries.
AFL coaches blame 6-day turnarounds for everything.
Yeah, so. Exactly. The team hasn't won in 4 months. 6-day turnaround, mate. Come on. Cool. So a huge week for the IPA this week. We obviously, you would have seen by now that we've released our poll that we did with Research Now on Australia Day. That's making a lot of headlines. It's going off on Facebook. Pete, shall we talk to... We're talking to Bella about that later in the show,
yes,
the person who's doing all the media about it. But Pete, we should probably introduce the poll and talk about it for a little bit.
That's right. Well, we surveyed 1,000 Australians with it regarding their views on Australia Day. 70% said they didn't want the date to be moved from the 26th of January. 11% said it should be moved. 23% said that councils shouldn't conduct citizenship ceremonies on Australia Day. And 50% said they should. And I believe you had a few more stats there.
Sorry, 50% disagree with councils moving Australia Day citizenship ceremonies. So 76% of Australians believe Australia has a history of which to be proud. Only 9% disagree.
Mm-hmm.
And 87% of Australians are proud to be an Australian. Only 3% are not. So obviously there's like, you know, this whole media storm at the moment about we've got to move the date, Australia should be ashamed of its own history, and it's just so not in touch with what people actually think.
Not representative, as we spoke about with Jacinta Price last week.
Yes, exactly. So a bunch of stuff you guys can read. As Bella said in the poll, this poll confirms that the left-leaning elements of our politics and media that are obsessed with identity politics are completely out of step with the majority of Australians when it comes to our national day. They want to divide rather than unite Australians. You can read that poll and the media release on our website. We also, Bella was also in The Australian yesterday discussing the findings. We released a video that we filmed talking about the councils and a moving citizenship ceremonies. And we also talked to Wurundjeri elder Ian Hunter about what he made of it all. And yeah, pretty cool story. But Pete, you saw one thing.
So there's been a couple of developments in the last day or two. A boss, someone who runs a firm in Melbourne has offered their workers 2 days off if they boycott Australia Day. So if they turn up on Australia Day and work, he will give them 2 days off, which is an interesting approach.
Yeah. Well, to me, this is one of those stories that I ain't spending any time on, because in the meantime, every 3 months a person is torn to pieces by a crocodile in North Queensland.
Yeah.
No, seriously, it's just like, you know, you could say like, well, I don't want the day changed, this boss does, but it's like, it's him running his business. If he's happy to take the financial cost of paying people penalty rates and then also paying them to take 2 days off, then, you know, that's your business, mate. I can't really do anything.
Yeah.
That's my theory.
He can do what he wants. Also, the Victorian opposition today has promised, if elected, to sack councils that refuse to celebrate Australia Day.
Yes. Bold statement.
It is a bold statement. I don't know what I think, really.
Well, it's just like in your face, like immediately just, we're going to sack them.
Yeah.
It's like, whoa. Okay.
What did Turnbull do last week? Last year, he stripped them of their rights to conduct citizenship.
Yeah, he just said you can't change it. Like you have to hold citizenship ceremonies on that day no matter what you want.
Yeah. I don't know if
I think that's just
rolling back democracy is really the...
No, I think it's just a bit of a headline grab from Matthew Guy. It's like, you know, I'm not really dominating the narrative at the moment. Let's say something that's going to make headlines.
I wonder if that will actually happen.
So we'll move on. Another big story making headlines this week. So the US government shut down for 69 hours, which is crazy. Second time that's happened recently. So if you guys didn't follow this story too closely, so Trump and the Republicans and Democrats sort of had a loggerheads over immigration. Trump wants his wall. Democrats want the Dreamers, so people that were like born in America but to illegal immigrants.
I thought it was people that came to America as children.
Oh, yeah. Well, basically people that didn't choose to come to America or like born, et cetera. So Obama said, you guys are all American citizens. That might be well back. Sorry, they're at a loggerheads. And so what happened was the Democrats used their power to stop the budgeting for immigration, which caused the government shutdown, and they blinked. So Democrats went a bit too far with it. They've now repealed. So Trump wins. and government's back. It's crazy that a government can shut down. Like, when you see those images of the guys, like, you know, putting the lock on the Smithsonian, just like, you can't come in. It's crazy seeing those images.
It is. It's like those governments that don't have an actual government for a few months and the economy goes nuts, like in Belgium.
Yeah, the best goes nuts in an upward way.
Yeah, in a good way,
Oh, can I tell you one tweet that I saw? There was this gym in Washington where there weren't enough towels on the day, first day of the government shutdown. People were just like, this is the real effects of the government shutdown.
Was it
my
serious?
My heart goes out to you.
Was it serious?
I think that, well, it was like, this is what I'm hearing when I went to the gym today. It was like there was a lack of towels due to the government shutdown.
But the government doesn't provide towels. Unless it's like the laundry. No, I don't know.
Yeah. Either way, probably not the worst thing that's happening.
Yeah, exactly.
Probably because there's the government's shutdown, so the economy's shut down as well, the business is shutting down.
Yeah.
But that's why there's no laundry for towel. Does that make sense?
It does make sense, Nate. But
none of this makes sense.
When they talk about government shutdown,
yeah,
it does. It's not like absolutely everything.
Yeah, exactly.
It's like the museums and stuff.
There was like a list of the things that stay open. And the funny thing was, like, Mueller's investigation of Trump was the number one thing that stays open. I'm just like, hang on. Number three thing that stays open. It's like, well, I don't know if that's what people are logging in for. Maybe they are. Cool. So if you guys want to hear more about the government shutdown, there was a really cool article by Rich Lowry in the New York Post, which I think we're going to be featuring in Hey Today.
Oh, sneak preview.
Yeah. Well, by the time the podcast goes out, no, because this will beat Hey out. So it is a sneak preview. So it's a good explainer of how the Democrats messed this up and how Chuck Schumer sort of messed this up for them. One thing I did like was, so immediately all of the journalists were like, well, the Democrats are shutting down. And the Democrats thought they'd be able to get away with saying Trump shut it down because he's not compromising with us. It's his fault that we're blockading. And the media were like, that's not exactly what we're saying. But there was a Twitter war as to whether the hashtag Schumer shutdown or Trump shutdown was going to win.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if that's how you capture the hearts and minds of people. Like Mark Ruffalo tweeted Trump shutdown 40 times in a tweet.
Mm-hmm.
Is that going to really swing people's picture of what's happening, Mark Ruffalo?
Yeah. I'm not sure.
Did it swing you, Pete?
I didn't know about it till just then. My favourite thing about the shutdown was that Schumer and Trump, the negotiations about the shutdown broke down as they were meeting over cheeseburgers.
Oh.
I blame the cheeseburgers.
Nice. Yeah.
No, I think if you can't come to terms over a cheeseburger, then there's probably deeper problems that just can't be solved.
Yep.
We can solve it out of a pizza.
Yeah. Well, they should have tried pizza. And Trump's a notoriously prickly guy when it comes to cheeseburgers. We all saw that story of him leaving the aide behind at the like when they were doing the campaign. They left an aide at a Macca's when they were on the road because the guy's order took too long. And Trump's like, "No, we're getting out of here."
Really?
So the aide's just standing there in the middle of a McDonald's on the highway.
That's classic political aide.
Yeah, that's also classic. Don't order from the luxury menu on a road trip.
I mean, presumably they didn't know they had a presidential candidate coming because otherwise you'd make sure that everything was ready. Anyway.
They should order while they were on the way.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, like flying ahead to the Maccas.
Yeah.
Couldn't see, this is why Nina should be a campaign manager.
Hey, hire me.
All right, fake news.
Yeah, so last week we laughed at Brazil and France for instituting the fake news rapid, fake news response teams, the allowing police to crack down on fake news. So we all had a big laugh and we thought, that's crazy. It'll never happen. It happened even more.
It happened
even bigger. So, UK government, remember, allegedly a conservative party, is now establishing a new unit to counter fake news, Downing Street has said. So this is coming from, I think, the BBC.
A rapid response unit.
Yeah, rapid response. So,
no less.
Yes. So Theresa May's spokesman, so Theresa May's spokesman. Just stands out there vaping all day. Theresa May's spokesman said that the dedicated National Security Communications Unit would be charged with combating disinformation by state actors and others. A committee of MPs is currently carrying out an inquiry into the growing phenomenon and has demanded information from Facebook and Twitter relying on Russian activity during the EU referendum. So I really love whenever the political class don't get their way, it's now immediately the fault of Russian interfering. The Clinton lost because of the Russians and now Brexit happened because of the Russians.
As I said last week, I just can't believe no one's ever thought of this before.
Yeah, exactly. Why don't more governments crack down on news they don't like?
It's just
lying there for the taking.
Because truth is so absolute.
Mm. All right, cool. That's all we've got for the openers here. We'll now go to our interviews with Bella and Darcy. Going to be talking to Bella about the Australia Day stuff and Darcy about the latest edition of the IPA review. Going to be talking through a few of our favourite articles and also a bit of cryptocurrency chat for those who enjoy that. But before we do that, we better talk membership, Nina.
Yes. So for you guys who haven't been a member of the IAPA, this is like actually a great time to become a member,
mm-hmm.
especially if you are supporting Abella's Paul.
Yes, exactly.
So this is the best time for you to join us. Just visit our website, iapa.org.au, and click on that join button. And you can start signing up as low as $22. And while becoming a member, you will get that, what did I miss?
Making its grand return.
A grand return.
Later
this afternoon, which is James just gave out the sneak peek.
Oh, bit of a peek behind the curtain.
Wanted to know what's that. And also you're going to have receive free subscriptions to IPA Review, which Darcy will talk about it.
Absolutely. And so obviously with the Australia Day stuff, there's not a whole lot of think tanks out there making the case that Australians don't want the day changed or standing up for Western civilization like that. So if you do want to become a part of the group that's sort of arguing for these issues, make sure you join the IPA. But we'll go to our interviews right now. Okay, we are now joined by the IPA's director of our Foundations of Western Civilization program, very good friend of the show, Dr. Bella DeBrera. Welcome back.
Thank you again. I think this is my fourth appearance.
And each of them have gotten better, which is huge omen.
Thank God.
For the rest of this interview.
Yeah, it was pretty bad at the beginning, but
we got there. It was a bit grim. Rough start.
It was a bit grim.
No, they've all been great.
Cool. Sorry, Bella. Obviously, a huge day for you. We are recording this on Wednesday, the day that the IPA's poll on how people feel about Australia Day has come out. All over the Australian, all over online, going absolutely insane on our Facebook page. So let us talk about it. So Bella, talk to us about the poll and what we found.
So we asked a cross-section of society, about 1,000 people, what we asked them some very transparent questions. We asked them, are they proud to be Australian? Are they proud of Australia's history? And do they want to change the date of Australia Day? They were the three main questions. And all the answers were very positive in terms of being proud of being Australian, wanting to celebrate our history and wanting to celebrate it on the 26th of January.
Yeah, absolutely. So I'll just run through some stats. We had them at the top of the show, but just to give people some reference, 70% of Australians believe Australia Day should be celebrated on 26th of January, with only 11% thinking that date should be moved. Only 23% of Australians think councils should stop holding citizenship ceremonies on the 26th of January. 50% of Australians disagree with these councils. 76% of Australians believe Australia has a history of which to be proud. Only 9% disagree. And 87% of Australians are proud to be Australian. Only 3% are not. Which is so clearly not the narrative that people have been hearing from the media over the last few weeks and basically whenever Australia Day rolls around.
Yeah, that's the thing. It's really highlighted for me just this huge chasm between what Australians want and what they believe and what they think and how they see themselves to how they're portrayed by the media and by politicians. Some politicians, how they see themselves, especially the Greens, obviously not wanting to name and shame anyone, but Richard Di Natale, for example.
That is, you specifically.
Yeah, I think we knew where we were going. Simon Breeny actually tweeted today that 11% of people think the date should be moved, and the Greens' election results, the last election was 10.3%. So,
I wonder if there's a correlation.
Yeah.
So what's been the reaction to these poll results then, Bella?
Well, the reaction has been positive by the majority, because it's the majority who have given us a positive result.
Yeah, the majority of people are going to
agree with what we've said, because this is what they said.
You're a woman of the people, Bella.
Apparently. Actually, I did have a criticism this morning from someone who didn't really like the poll results and also said as a PS that I was willing to talk about Australians and I was willing to talk about their points of view, but I was very secret and I didn't publish my own details, but he'd sent me an email. So
sorry, he has some details.
He does some details.
It's like, you haven't added me on Snapchat.
Yeah, you haven't added me on Snapchat.
You haven't seen any of my Snap stories today.
But he still managed to track me down fairly easily and send me an email. I mean, he can ring me in the office if he wants to, because our number's online as well. So.
All right, and I guess you've also invited all of the listeners of the show to do that, so huge news.
What about some of our political opponents, journalists and stuff like that?
Well, the journalists have said predictably that polls are skewed and we've asked leading questions just to get the results that we want because it's predictable because we're
And these are the exact same journalists who also took the Australia Institute to task for...
No, they did not take the Australia Institute to task. Strangely enough, they said they were completely silent about their poll, which is blatantly... I mean, if you read the questions, as we might do here, they're very leading.
Yeah, exactly. And they didn't even release the poll results for should the date be changed.
No.
Sorry.
No, they didn't. Because
so they just didn't release that question at all.
Well, like, there's no public information. Like, if they asked that question, they might not have asked a question, but if they did ask a question, they certainly didn't make the results public.
We don't know if they didn't get the question. But look, we released everything. We've been totally transparent, all the answers, all the questions, and all the percentages and what people thought.
So I've got some reactions that we've got from the online community. So this is a little mean tweet segment. They're not too mean, don't worry. But it's I'm liking this. So on the Facebook post, we posted up the infographic. People can go see that. It's one of the results to whether or not the date should be moved. And in the comments, I've also put a link to the poll. And people have been really baited by this. They have started really having a go at us saying, like, oh, we've only asked 1,000 people. Mm. Like, how can we say these results are trustworthy if we've only asked 1,000 Australians? And to those people, I'd say, don't do any research as to how polls work, because you are going to be disturbed by what you find. Because most polls, in fact, pretty much every poll, would ask 1,000 people.
Mm-hmm. Well, the Australian Institute asked 1,000 people.
Yeah.
Yeah. We use the same company.
Yeah, but...
Did we?
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And one was like, well, I don't think research now have got a good face for themselves, because two terrible. Wildly different poll results. I also like this one. So Contour... The IPA is such an independent group. Not.
It's
so 1990s.
Yeah. It's like, I have not heard a not joke since Borat.
It's very 1990s.
I'm kind of
2000s.
Comforted by that. But you can still just do a not.
Yeah, you can just really level at that.
It's a good fallback.
I don't think you can do a not. Not.
Very good. Thanks, Dad.
Cool. So, let's talk about this Australia Institute poll. Australian Institute, obviously, last week made a bunch of headlines for their poll, and their big takeaway was that while 84% of people think that it's important that Australia has a national day of commemoration and celebration, most Australians don't really mind when we hold Australia Day as long as we do. So that, to me, isn't really a massive takeaway of Australians want the date changed. It's like it's just that they want an Australia Day. And then when it becomes the question of, if we do move it to where, that's when the whole campaign to change the date falls over, because there's not a unifying date they can say. I'm hearing, like, you know, January 1 because of Federation. I'm hearing, like, May 8th because it'll be mate.
Yeah. I heard May 9th today. The University of Western Australia have just released a short film saying they want it to be on May the 9th.
What was their reason?
The foundation of... government, some parliament somewhere, something.
That's going to unite the country.
Yeah.
That is going to have groundswell
support. Going to be somewhat, it's going to offend somebody.
Yeah.
So May 8 was because it's May.
Yeah, that was by Jordan Raskopoulos. Oh, like, it was a video that Jordan Raskopoulos did with, I want to say Junkie. But yeah, it was just basically like an online video. Oh, it's mate. We all like mates. But, you know, then mate can be a bit gender specific. I don't know if we can really go down that path. So,
well, the problem is every day can offend everybody in some way.
Exactly.
So the Triple J have moved the Australia Day top 100 to the 27th of January, which happens to be National Holocaust Memorial Day.
So tripping on someone else's turf, I think. So I got one more question. So on this topic of, like, the shame of the history, like, we can't get a date that unites itself. Like, I think one of it, and what our poll finds, to go back to it, is to say that 76% of Australians have a history which to be proud. This comes in your article. There's just so much to be proud of in Australia's history that we should celebrate this January 26.
Yes, and I always feel like I'm just repeating myself, but, you know, everything to do with Western civilization, all the values and the principles and everything that makes Australia the great country that it is today comes directly from Britain and from Western civilization. So by rejecting Australia Day, the 26th, you're really rejecting Western civilization.
And which goes along with, like, you know, rule of law, individual liberty.
Liberal democracy, equality, toleration, inquiry.
I think that's really important. I've sort of have this thing that Australia Day, the argument about Australia Day, on the one side we have the whole guilt thing, you know, we shouldn't be celebrating because of X, Y, Z. And on the other side, we only kind of have the flag waving brigade, the, you know, Australia Mate Brigade.
Yeah.
You know, there's a place for that, but we don't have, well, the only people that really provide the philosophical proper argument for the importance of Western civilization is kind of us, and specifically you. And you had that piece in the Oz today I believe today.
Yes.
Yep, today, which articulated that really well. So if you could maybe summarise that briefly for us, as you just did, that would be fantastic.
Well, look, Western civilization has provided us with our cultural and our historical basis for this nation. Without Western civilization, modern Australia just wouldn't exist. We wouldn't be sitting here in a studio lit by electricity and in a building that's been made of concrete, and we wouldn't be sitting here having a discussion about these values at all, because they wouldn't exist. So everything that we do, where we get up in the morning and we get through our daily business and we're not attacked in the streets and we have recourse to the law and we're men and women are equal before the law, it all comes from Western civilization.
Mm-hmm.
And these are things that make Australia, and the fact that, you know, we're such a... our liberal democracy is the envy of the world. And we haven't had a war.
Yep.
We've been in peace. This has been a country of peace, apart from First and Second World Wars, which is obviously we were drawn into.
And they were far away.
And they were far away from us.
For the most part, yeah.
It's a pretty good country in relation to the rest of the world. And actually, one of the poll questions is about Australia compared to the rest of the world. And I think a very high number of people think Australia is a much better country than many other countries.
Yeah, absolutely.
So just a slight change of direction for a final question. You and I were talking earlier today about the psychological factors that drive people to feel guilt for stuff, and how that is an important and actually feel good about feeling guilt, and about that's an important component of the drive to change Australia Day. Do you want to outline that a little bit more for our listeners?
Yeah, look, it was just something I was thinking about this morning, because obviously we understand that there is a problem. We understand that there are people in our society who are very much concerned with the date, and they're very much concerned with what happened, and they're very much concerned with this clash of cultures, and they look at the dark side of it rather than the light side of it, and they take on the guilt of people that weren't necessarily even their ancestors. So they could be second or third Italian generation Australians, or, you know, people who can't even claim that they had ancestors on the first fleet, but they still take on that guilt, that the guilt of the first settlers and the guilt of the British and the guilt, this colonization. And I was talking to my brother this morning, who's a psychiatrist, saying, you know, what is this? And he just basically saying, there are people who get pleasure out of feeling guilt. It's a sort of strange, inexplicable, he sort of used the word masochistic, like it's taking on a sort of a pain and a guilt, but enjoying it and making you feel better. And it sort of gives you a sort of moral superiority. And you feel better because you feel better morally than someone else who's not feeling guilty about something. So I think that's an interesting angle that we're not really talking about, but it's driving them. It's driving them to change the date. It's driving, this is a guilt and a shame that's driving them to do this.
All right, cool. So Bella, thanks so much for joining us. Now, if our listeners want to read more about the stuff we've been doing today, talking about today, so they can go to our website. Our poll results are there. You can read through all of it. You can read through the full results. You can also read Bella's article in The Australian, which we referenced on Facebook and YouTube. You can also see a video we've made discussing Australia Day and where these pushes for the counts come, and whether or not they are actually representative of the counts, of the people that pay council rates. And anything else people can read? Your article in the IPA reviews. Oh, that's more about identity politics.
Yeah, no, that's identity politics.
You know, we'll talk about that with Darcy coming up.
Are you on Twitter, Bella?
No. No, I'd like to stay clear of Twitter, if that's okay with you.
I'll allow it.
Thank you.
Cool. All right, Bella, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks, Bella.
Thanks.
Say up.
Okay, we are now joined by IPA Research Fellow and Editor of the IPA Review, Dr. Darcy Allen.
It's great to be here.
Yeah, welcome back.
D-Money.
As we all call him. So D-Money, Editor of the Review, we had one over the break. We didn't get a chance to talk to you about it last year. It's still with the editors. But now that it's out, now that it's hit people's letterboxes, they've had a bit of a read, we can talk about...
At the beach.
Yep, that's where I recommend people always read the IPA Review, is next to a large body of water. But Darcy, let's talk about some of the articles that were in the review, what we liked, and then we can talk about where people can go to read future editions of the IPA Review. But Darcy, so obviously, big cover story, talking about identity politics at university.
Great cover.
Yes, very cool cover. And obviously, like, we don't want to get into this too deeply, because we did talk to Bella at length about her report last year, and this is basically summing up sort of just what was in her report, etc. But Darcy, was there anything about this article that really stood out for you?
Well, I think this is a really interesting topic. The topic of the article is called the the future of history. And the focus here is on identity politics, and it's something that keeps coming up in many, many debates that we see in politics. And the main finding of, so this is based on a report, and the main finding was from the report is we looked at 746 history subjects in Australia, undergraduate history subjects, and looked at how many of those
which
were...
Which are all of the ones that are taught at universities. So
yes,
not
so
just
I think
like
that's across about...
746.
Yes, I think that's across about 35 universities.
Important distinction to make.
Thank
yes,
you.
And we looked at how many of those history subjects were viewed through the prism of identity politics.
Mm-hmm.
So through these ideas of race and class and gender.
Yeah,
so
yeah. Not putting people into groups as opposed to celebrating the individual. Yeah.
Instead of talking about, for instance, events such as the Industrial Revolution. So there's around 250 of the history subjects are viewed through this lens. And this is a really sort of troubling phenomenon because at the same time we looked at if we write down 20 of the core things that we think should be taught in Western civilization, that's things like ancient Greece, the history of Christianity,
yep.
Only 3 universities in Australia teach all 20 of those subjects.
Which is pretty bad. 3 out of 35.
Yes.
Yeah. Mm.
So Bella went through this in her article, and the real question here is what can we do about this? So as people who believe in freedom and liberty, how do we overcome these challenges?
Yeah.
And I think what we really need is a multi-pronged approach.
Yeah, so my favorite part of this article, and I'm going to hit it with you guys. I know we discussed this with Bella last year, but here are some subjects that are on offer at Australian universities right now, and you guys have to pick one that you're going to study. You have to pick one.
Okay.
All right. So, a history of sexualities at the University of Melbourne.
Yep.
Sexualities. Food for thought, discovering the world through commodities, taught at La Trobe University. And white supremacy or masculinity, nostalgia and change. Jeez. Each of those offered at the University of Western Australia.
That last one sounds heavy. Absolutely grim.
I'm going to go with food for thought.
Food for thought.
Some sort of practical element.
We're going
in
for the
that,
sex, I imagine.
And who is that surprising? Cool. So, Pete, anything you liked about that one?
The word map contained... What are they called? Word map?
Word cloud.
World cloud. Yeah, the world cloud. The word cloud contained...
Someone's never done year 10 geography.
In that... Oh, well, I did it in 2000. So, the word cloud...
The Young IPA podcast.
Contained in that was very funny. You've got there, yeah. So, the words that come up are not the words you'd expect to see in a well-rounded history course. Any feedback...
So, these are the most used words in university course titles.
And descriptions.
Yeah, yes. Cool.
And the major ones, I'm looking at the word cloud here, and we've got words like Indigenous, race, gender, environment. They're the most common keywords in all of these history subjects.
That's right. So it's not that those things shouldn't be studied at all. It's just that there's a complete lack of balance.
Yeah, exactly. Cool. So...
There you go.
No, I was going to say, should we move on to the next article?
Yeah, let's move on to the next one. Yep. Yep. So I enjoyed this one.
It's a bit of a book club situation, haven't we? So what do we all like?
I've never been to a book club, but I'll take your word for that. By Morgan Begg and Simon Breeny, the 10 worst constitutional mistakes that Australia has made. This is funny because Morgan is such a constitutional nerd.
Yeah.
So I just loved reading this.
He's also a big guy on pointing out other people's errors. There's a bit of an office joke at the moment that his last few... whenever his articles are mentioned on the front page of the Spectator Australia, the last few have been Brandis wrong or Turnbull wrong or something like that. It's just a whole bunch of like, these are the things that are wrong with the world. And now he's turned his eye to the Constitution.
Yeah.
High Court wrong was another one.
That's Morgan, isn't it, I guess. Yeah. But very interesting. Highlights, Darcy, of that.
So this article here by Morgan and Simon, it really looked at, this is important when we're talking about the Constitution because it determines what our federation looks like, where the powers sit. Do they sit with the federal government or do they sit with the state government? And that's basically what the Constitution determines. And most of the mistakes that Morgan and Simon have pointed out are ones that centralise the power in Canberra. So it gives more power to the federal government. So, for example, the tied grants power means that the federal government can provide funds to the states and attach conditions to them. And we see this in things like education policy. The power about external affairs means that the Commonwealth government can make laws regarding external affairs. And that means if they sign, for instance, a treaty about environmental law, which is not a remit that the Commonwealth should be in, it means that they then have power to make legislation in that area, and we have a massive amount of Commonwealth legislation now in environmental law, and I think it's really, really troubling.
Yeah, and it's also like the number one here of Section 51, which is allows the government to sort of get involved with state issues. Like, it's so poorly worded that the government can just say this state issue needs a federal government approach and just get themselves into it the way the High Court has decided it, which is what we're seeing in like health and education and stuff.
Yeah, the recurring theme was that it gave the central government too much power.
Yeah.
Or gave the High Court the ability to interpret stuff.
Yeah, exactly. And I think that's a key thing as well. So it's not just the specific wording, it's how it's been interpreted and expanded through the High Court.
Yeah.
Real interesting stuff.
I also like number four here, seat of government. I always love it when the IPA gets its boots into the mere concept of Canberra, yeah. which really rolls up the
like
left.
Its existence.
Yeah, this exactly. comes up on Twitter a lot.
Yeah, it does. So for the uninitiated to this one, so about 8 or 9 years ago, we wrote an IPA review article piece, The 13 Biggest Mistakes Australia Ever Made, which made Canberra number one, which absolutely riled up anyone who'd ever lived in Canberra. Because, you know, we always found it a little weird that there was just one city which we decided, yep, that's where the seat of government is. Mm. You know, it's far away from any of the major cities. It's far away from most of the populations. So it's a bit of a bubble there.
Bubble or swamp.
Yeah, yep. Bubble or swamp, yeah. Whichever one. Some sort of residue around it. So I always love it when we get our boots stuck in a Canberra again.
Yeah.
All right, cool. So we'll move on to third one. So here's one I liked.
This is an absolute banger. This
it
one.
Was written by the podcast very good friend Dr. Oh no, sorry.
That's not even.
I thought we were recording this in 2019.
That is not even.
2019. That was a pure mistake.
Very good friend of the podcast, Peter Gregory.
Yeah.
Talking about the Atlas Foundation. So obviously one of the world's biggest think tanks. Atlas Foundation, it's launched a new program to help alleviate poverty by restoring economic rights to the poor. So, Pete, do you want to talk us through what the Atlas Foundation is doing?
Yeah, I can do that. So, before we do that,
I hope so. Your name's right here on
you've
the
You've received a lot of positive feedback about this piece, haven't you, Darcy?
Yes, overwhelming.
Yeah, yeah. From Peter Gregory, P. Gregory, PG.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, my parents. Yeah, no, so.
Solved poverty again.
This is just about the Atlas Foundation, which is obviously an American organization, which has a network of think tanks throughout the developing world and the developed world, but this part is focused on the developing world. Which helps grassroots entrepreneurs in developing countries get economic rights like property rights and the rule of law and the removal of really onerous regulation. It's based on the world, some work they've done in conjunction with the World Bank, which found that for every, I think it was, I wrote this in December. For every 5 points that they improved on the World Bank survey of ease of doing business, they improved. Reduced the number of people in poverty by 1% in that country or something like that.
You're making this up, aren't you?
No, that's in there.
It's not a quiz.
Anyway, whatever it is, if they found by improving economic freedom, they could actually, obviously, as we've been saying, improve the lives of a lot of people really quickly. So a lot of it's stuff like, you know, removing how quickly it is to start a business in Nepal, enabling people in South Africa to get property rights to their houses, stuff like that.
Yeah. I think this is really interesting because these are ideas that we've talked about for decades, centuries, these ideas, we know these institutions are fantastic for human flourishing. But the question is, how do you go and implement them tomorrow in these countries? And you can take a number of approaches. You could try and overhaul an entire system and put in democracy and so on, do some sort of extreme change. Or the focus of this program is on achieving small marginal changes that actually have massive benefits to the people on the ground.
Yeah, absolutely. And like the way that's set up right now with the governments giving aid to other governments is just completely ramming your head against a brick wall over and over again.
Yeah.
Yeah.
This is a lot of our people are like, I would love to give money to an organization that would help. I'd love to give money to an organization that will help fight poverty, but there's nothing out there for me, so I don't. Whereas this is kind of like, now there is something out there for you. A coordinating role they're playing.
Yeah, so if you do want to get involved, it's the Atlas Foundation's Doing Develop Differently program. So
that's it, yeah.
Google that. Yeah. Cool. So my favorite part of the article was actually the first paragraph, which is usually a huge sign that you actually didn't do the readings when you just start quoting from the opening paragraph, but I did read this, Pete.
I think Darcy made me... This was originally not my first... I just read it first.
Cool. So as Harvard Development Expert...
That was my paragraph. No.
Yeah. That's why he's the editor, Pete. As Harvard development expert Land Pritchard says, there are no poor people. There are only people living in poor places.
Yeah, well said.
Yeah. So, well, could you sort of elaborate on that? Like, what does that mean?
So, yeah, that was like my third or fourth paragraph, and Darcy said I should make that the first, so I should give him credit for that.
Goodbye, Darcy. Good.
Yeah, that's why he's the king. That just means that, you know, what decides whether a country is rich or not is the institutional environment, rule of law, property rights, free markets, that kind of stuff. you know, pretty much everyone will prosper if they're in an environment like that, and that pretty much everyone will not prosper if they're in an environment where those things aren't present.
Mm. It's such an important thing. Cool. So there are highlights. You can, like, if you're an IPA member, you would have already received the IPA review.
Yes.
So if you want to receive this IPA review, sign up as a member quickly. So obviously earlier in the podcast, we would have told you where you can go to become a member. And Das, is it? I know the next review is a few months away, so people have got time to buy it. Do we have any sort of teaser as to what we're thinking about for the next?
Well, the thing I'm thinking at the moment is it's always quite nice to reflect in January and think what is going to happen this year in politics in Australia. What are going to be the big decisions? So I'm hoping that this next
one—it's
probably
not a lot. If last year's a huge indicator,
yeah, there's not much happening. Yeah, that's correct. So this is why I have a lot of time to reflect. Yeah. And I think what we're going to do with this one is do a little bit more of agenda setting for the year. So yep. What do we think the big issues are in 2018? And I think they're things like tax cuts, I think, is something that's going to keep going on. We obviously talk about red tape a lot mm-hmm. at the IPA. Energy policy is going to continue as we see these blackouts and so on. And this idea that I talked about in the editorial in the current edition, the December edition, this idea of federalism and revitalizing the idea of federalism, I think, is going to be very, very important. And that'll come together more so in GST debates, yeah. which we've got, I think, 3 state elections this year.
Yeah.
So that's always something that might come up. But yeah.
Hopefully, yeah.
If anyone wants to send in any articles, please feel free to email me.
Yeah, dallen@ipa.org.au.
Correct.
That's it.
For D-Money on Twitter.
My very informative tweets about blockchain. Yeah. Yes. All of my tweets are about blockchain.
Well, should mention that. Yeah. What a segue. We've seen a little bit of a Bitcoin crash in the last couple of weeks.
That wasn't planned, that segue, but yes.
To do.
I thought you were going to say that wasn't planned, that crash, but it's like, yeah, I'd hope so.
In part with the regulatory environment in South Korea. Now, you have a lot of views about cryptocurrency. Why don't you, not commenting specifically on that situation, but the impact of the regulatory environment on cryptocurrencies in general.
Yeah.
I think that when we...
He does it all, this bloke.
When we talk about... blockchain is a very exciting, fast-moving area that lets us look at things that we know exist on a much smaller scale with other technologies. And what we know with new technologies is that at the very, very beginning, we're in a discovery phase and we don't really know what that technology is for. To be honest, no one really knows what we're using blockchains for at the moment. We're all very excited about it.
CryptoKitties seems to be the big use of the moment.
I am the owner of a CryptoKitty, and if anyone would like to buy my CryptoKitty, they can. There's not too many out there that would like it, but that's fine. It only costs me $17.
I'm not even kidding, Pete. The biggest industry right now in cryptocurrency is people just like creating and selling kitties they draw.
But this is...
$17.
So this is very, very emblematic of what the phase that we're in at the moment within blockchain. So... Mm. Someone came up with this game effectively where you could buy and sell these virtual cats on the blockchain. And that doesn't sound that exciting. Sounds a bit crazy, a bunch of libertarians sitting on the internet buying and selling cats.
Mm-hmm.
But what if they were property titles? What we're talking about here is we're talking about how do we create a secure market for information and, well, that's really what we're talking about here. We're talking about information about who owns what. How do we create that on the blockchain? And they're buying and selling cats, but... In the future, that could easily be intellectual property. It could be many, many different things.
Countries.
Okay.
Maybe
that's not. I'd like to buy a country.
But that could happen.
Yeah.
But back to this idea about regulation and what's happening at the moment. We have seen a massive crash and we see various governments come out and try and shut down cryptocurrencies, or they try and regulate the exchanges into cryptocurrencies. This idea we see at the start of all new technologies where, depending on the regulatory environment of a country, the billions of dollars of investment that are flying around the world,
mm-hmm.
they will go to the country with the most conducive regulatory environment.
Like anything else.
Exactly. And I think I've actually talked about this briefly on the podcast before with drones. New Zealand had a very conducive environment for drones, and then Domino's set up their trial pizza delivery mm-hmm. service there. So we're seeing this at the moment in blockchain. And the interesting thing then is to say, well, what should governments do as a sort of policy about blockchain? If we don't know what it's for, how do we move forward and get the investment in Australia? And I think the way you do that is you try and decrease what we would call regime uncertainty. as an economist. So mm-hmm. this idea that the government
so is democracy.
Rapidly going to change, rapidly going to change the rules like they did in South Korea. They come along and they just change the rules tomorrow. And before you know it, it's banned.
Yeah.
And if the Australian government was to do anything about blockchain right now, it would be basically reassuring people that we're not going to make any really hasty decisions.
Yeah.
Here is clearly laid out what the tax implications are of having cryptocurrencies. Yeah. Yes, they're assets and you pay capital gains tax on them, for instance. So I think the role of the government here is really to provide certainty to investors, but also don't go out and create a Blockchain Act 2018, because that would be one of the worst things that you could do.
Yeah, and surely the stuff that's happening in South Korea would be a natural teething phase of something as so revolutionary as cryptocurrency, where governments are just like, we don't quite know what this is. It could hurt a lot of our voters, so therefore we're going to ban it. And then
they'll come back
and they'll go, actually, this can be used for good. And then that's when my Bitcoin goes up again.
I'm going to buy some.
Yes.
Hey, do it. I keep telling you.
From our perspective, is if we want to go to, if we want Australia to be a country with a lot of investment in blockchain, which presumably we do, you can't miss this first phase. South Korea has basically just done a little bit of irreparable damage to whether they're going to get investors or not in the future.
Yeah.
And hopefully Australia can make some better steps forward in hopefully. This area.
Cool. So Darcy, thank you so much for joining us. Once again, if you do want to get yourself a copy of the IPA Review and future copies of the IPA Review, always a really good read. Australia's oldest, I think the world's oldest free market magazine.
Mm.
We can claim that. Yeah, that's fine. I think right there's now. A small competition. You know, they didn't keep records of anything back in the day, but I think there might be one other person.
Where's your records, mate? Cool. All right, Darcy, thank you so much for joining us.
Fantastic. Thank you. Fine.
Okay, thank you to Darcy and Bella for those chats. Really fun stuff. So we'll run through some stories that caught our eye this week. Pete, let's start with Oxford University.
Well, this was amazing, James. During the week, it emerged at Oxford University during the summer of 2017, had increased the time taken to do maths and computer science examinations because they thought, and I quote, female candidates might be more likely to be adversely affected by time pressure. So
was this statement made in 1848?
It's I guess they're fragile, you know, personalities can't deal with pressure. This is what
their
happens.
Their minds are overloaded.
What happens with all, okay, my theory is with all the stuff about grievance politics and identity politics, all the measures taken are massively, massively patronizing
mm-hmm.
and generally sexist, racist, homophobic, whatever you want to call it.
Yeah.
And this is just a really obvious example of it.
Yeah, absolutely.
Like all of it.
Completely agree. Yeah.
So, yeah, I did diversity training with my cricket club
yeah.
to get a grant, right? I'm like, this is stupid, but I'll do it along with a few other people at the club to get a grant.
So you've taken government money.
Yes, we've taken government money.
Nina, write that down.
Okay.
Let's have a record.
And I don't know if we got the grant, actually. But anyway, so we did the
training. So you sold out your soul for nothing.
And some of the stereotypes in there about dealing with people from different backgrounds were shocking. It's like, hang on, how is this, you know, meant to be a way of bringing us together? It's perpetuating.
Do you have a specific?
I do have a specific. I don't know if I want
a question without notice.
I don't know if I want to go into the specific.
I feel the story called for a specific. Nina, what do you reckon?
Yeah, tell us all.
Come on.
Well,
story
okay.
time with Pete.
So the bit about, and we can, yeah, okay. The bit about.
You don't believe this.
Yeah, I know.
So I think we're fine.
Yeah, I know. Okay, so it had like a page on each. Ethnic minority, right?
Yeah.
And one of those pages was Indigenous players,
mm-hmm.
and it said Indigenous players, you know, and I paraphrase, and this is why I'm sort of a bit iffy about saying it because I don't want to get it wrong. But so this is from Cricket Australia.
Yeah.
Indigenous players may not understand punctuality the same way as non-Indigenous players. We've got Indigenous players at our club, right? And if you suggested to them, oh, you didn't have to be on time because you're Indigenous, they'd knock your head off. Like, it's just, it's crazy.
Sure, that's the most patronising thing I've ever heard in my life.
This is in it, and I was like, you know, where's the data for that anyway?
Yeah, exactly.
So stuff like that, and you know, if my mum was in the computer industry in the '70s, a massively male dominated field, and if you once again, she might not knock your head off,
yeah.
but if you suggested to her that you know you need more time because you're a woman, she'd tell you where to go.
Yeah, well, exactly. So this is our whole thing. When the IPA talks about identity politics and like the classification into groups, it's always coming back to this theory that just like, oh. some of the victims of our society. Like, these groups are the victims of our society, the way it's set up. And it's just so infantilizing to tell kids, like, you. And this is leading us to our next story here, which is at Fordham University in America, a black law professor has argued that African Americans should embrace the notion that being black in America is a disability.
Yeah.
Like, she's actually telling students, you are disabled.
Yeah.
Because you're black.
Oh, yeah. My God.
Like, this society, like... You should. I can't believe that story. Imagine being in that class, being told you are disabled.
She is. Yeah.
So her reasoning is. So she's got this article up in the Fordham Law Review, I think it was. The
Fordham Law Center on Race, Law, and Justice.
Peter Gregory does his research. Blackness in the United States has an independent disabling effect, distinct from the effects of socioeconomic status. What is it with law people and just writing the most incoherent babble?
I don't know, mate.
Like, just one, that's not a sentence. But anyway, the point is, we're basically telling an entire generation, society is set up to discriminate you. You are disabled.
Yeah.
And how is that going to, you know, give people a spirit or just like celebrate what makes the world great?
Yeah, exactly. She's keying into the thing. She's saying, oh, you know, discrimination doesn't have to be deliberate.
Right.
So in disability law, according to what she's written, in America, you can say people are being discriminatory even if they're not deliberately being discriminatory, which is once again this unconscious bias thing.
Yeah,
you know. So what was I going to say?
I don't know.
No, yeah. So my big point is, yeah, as I've made a couple of times, is that all these things are a little bit racist.
Yes.
Apart from all the other reasons why identity politics is bad,
mm-hmm,
it's also a little bit racist.
Yes, I would say a lot bit racist.
Yes.
Anyway, we'll move on. So another story. And again, this is like the stuff that outrages us. So really getting our mornings off to a fly here. So this article was in Reason Online, obviously a really cool website, by Eric Bowen. So in Tennessee, you apparently need a high school diploma to be able to cut people's hair. And as has happened to one hairdresser, Eli Cerati, he had his entire hairdressing place shut down because a cop came in and was like, where's your license? He says, I don't have one. I didn't finish high school. Cop shuts the whole place down.
Yep. Great.
Because we wouldn't want poor people getting a leg up in life, would we?
Yeah.
That's crazy to me.
So he's a hairdresser.
He's a hairdresser.
So he just cut people's hair.
Cut people's hair.
And the place shut down because he doesn't have a license because he hasn't finished high school.
Yep. Yeah.
Because you need year 12 English to
be a hairdresser. And, you know, you need to know what a parabola is.
Oh, yeah, true.
Otherwise,
you need to know the angles and all that.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I don't know about you guys.
You don't need to know that to be a two-bit podcast operator.
I don't know about you guys, but I do walk into every hairdresser and demand to see the high school diploma of every person in the store before I even sit down on a chair.
You might have to do a quiz before that.
Yeah, exactly. Like, who was Australia's first Prime Minister?
Oh. Licensing is...
As came up last week in Jacinta Price's interview.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. We knew.
We knew. Cool. So, yeah, according to the Tennessee Cosmetology Act...
What is that?
I don't know. I'm just quoting the article. Yeah, to qualify for a hair cutting license, you need a high school diploma.
Yeah.
Is there any other industry you can think of?
It's just
like you need a high school diploma to do?
I mean, like a doctor and stuff.
Maybe. All right, well, let's compare.
No, I mean, it would have just been some kind of, you know, back in the day, a group of hairdressers got together and thought,
how do we price people out of the market?
We need to block new entrants?
Yeah, yeah.
Something like that.
Let's protect our necks.
Or some obscure reason.
Mm, exactly. Cool. Let's go on to an actually fun story, Pete. Let's talk some straws.
Straws. So to continue on with local trans DJ God's concern with the straw issue.
Tune into last week's episode if you missed it.
This is no longer an issue just confined to Melbourne. It's an issue across the West.
Yep.
The restaurants in California will be prohibited from automatically handing out straws to customers under a bill introduced Wednesday. So I think that means... It's not actually a law yet. They're just discussing it. Assemblyman Ian Calderon, I don't know what Dewittier means. I think that's maybe where he's from.
Let me see it.
Okay.
Yeah, so he's a Democrat from the county of Whittier, I reckon. Yeah,
see? Cultured.
Yeah.
Introduced.
I know things.
Assembly bill. Anyway, it's a thing making restaurants have to not give out straws automatically, but people have to ask for them before they use them.
I never thought I'd say this, but long live government interference with private business. Get straws out of my face.
Bolt is, he's just like everyone else in government. He just wants to ban stuff he doesn't like.
Yep.
I'm part of the problem, not the solution.
That's what I would have thought, Nina. It's not.
And there could be a biodegradable straws, can you?
Yeah, exactly.
I mainly go.
I think they're mostly not, but you know,
I think that's a problem.
It could be.
I come back like this. To me, is the infantilizing. It's the infantilizing nature of the straw to say that I don't trust you to drink this out of the side of a cup. I mean, I'm not saying it's as infantilizing as telling your entire class that their blackness is a disability.
Yeah.
But it is infantilizing.
Well, but I mean, you might just want to sip on it.
Yeah. I want to make sure that I still have the drinks left.
And you shouldn't have to ask the waitress. What if it's really busy and the waitress is like, or waiter? There can be male waiters too.
That's 2017, 2018.
Yeah, exactly.
Obviously, I'm kidding. Like, this is ridiculous. I'm just saying, get straws out of my face. Yeah. I'm lifting this from another podcast, almost word for word, but how many holes does a straw have?
Two.
Really?
Yeah.
It's one hole the whole way through.
Oh, I knew that.
Yeah.
Oh, wow. Yes.
What did
or
you,
is it two?
You were going to say two. There's two.
Or is it?
Because the hole is the entrance.
Think about it.
What's a hole, actually?
Maybe there's no holes. Because if there's no bottom, it's not a hole.
Exactly.
So there's no holes.
It's crazy.
It's a tunnel.
Could be anything.
It's a tunnel.
So that was hole chat. Cool. So last thing we've got for this week. Debut of a new segment. We're going to see how this figures out. But So it's Know Your Internet. So obviously, I'm the IPA social media guy. I spend a lot of my day on the internet.
Oh, does he ever? It's not even.
In work-related matters, Pete.
NBA work related.
Of course.
Yeah. Look, guys, we're a team. We are a team.
Tab sport.
Sport. That's enough out of you, Pete. Cool. So we're a team here. So on Twitter, obviously, a few things pop up. On Facebook, a few other things pop up that I see, and they can be quite weird.
On
the internet.
No.
It's a weird place. Guys, if I were to say Tide Pods were making news, what would you think I would be referring to?
How do you spell it?
T-I-D-E, spacebar, P-O-D-S.
Do you want to go first, Nader?
Give Pete time to pad.
I've got an idea.
Pod in a Tide. I don't know. What's Tide Pod?
Why is it all over the internet?
So it's a thing that monitors the tides.
Okay.
It really?
You think it's something to do with the waves?
It's in pod form.
It's back in pod form. Nina, any guesses? Okay, rough start for this segment, but
a really quizzical look on your face.
Yeah.
Okay. In what's been deemed the first big social media meme of 2018, Tide Pod Challenge consists of biting into a capsule of concentrated laundry detergent in a bid to impress followers. While most of the memes poke fun at the idea that anyone would want to eat a Tide Pod, it would appear that enough people are really doing it for Facebook and YouTube to crack down on users posting challenge videos. On Saturday, a Utah State University student was reportedly rushed to hospital after eating one of the pods.
So you bit on that.
Yeah, so you buy those capsules of laundry detergent and you just eat it.
Social media.
Do you eat it or just bit it?
Eat it.
You have to eat it?
Yeah.
And
isn't
you swallow
poison?
It. No.
Is it poison?
I think that's why someone was rushed to hospital.
Not poison. There's
I don't think it's like, you know, a balanced diet.
Yeah. I reckon social media and the internet, like we've used it in a lot of ways to demonstrate our stupidity.
Yeah.
The stupid aspects of our personality.
Yeah.
Of humanity.
The Harlem Shake. Big indicator of how stupid people
Harlem
can get.
Shake is Harlem good, Shake. Actually. Yeah.
There was like three good videos and the rest were pretty average.
But at least, like, how many memes are there? It's like, you know, I have a cheeseburger and then I have three more. And then it's like, tag your mate. So you tag your mate who eats. It's just like, really? This is what we're doing?
Is this
greatest piece of technology ever? Why can't we talk about like our feelings or our fears?
Maybe these memes are the crypto kitties. Maybe the memes are the crypto kitties, and then the Facebook in general is like blockchain, where it's like right now it's these stupid memes, but it's what's happening in 10 years to refer to the Darcy chat. Maybe. Anyway, cool. That's all we got.
Sorry,
unless Pete's got an addendum.
Nah. Okay. That's done.
Okay, cool.
Bring it back. Can't wait for next week.
Wait, stop talking over the outro.
On the pod, the Tide Pod.
That is it for the podcast this week, despite Pete's protestations. Thank you guys so much for listening. Remember, we are available on iTunes, SoundCloud, and our website. If you enjoyed the show, leave us a 5-star review on iTunes to help us out with the rankings. If you like what the IPA is doing, obviously, this is a pretty big show, talking a lot about Australia Day poll results. Make sure you become a member of the IPA. Nina, what is that URL again?
It's ipa.org.au, and just click on the join button on the website.
Absolutely. $22 as the... Well, you can become a member for as low as $22.
And you will receive four subscription free magazines of IPA reviews, which Darcy had talked about before, and also weekly emails, hey, what did I miss, from James Bold, Pete Gregory, and Morgan Bagg.
Cool. All right. That's it. See you guys next week.
Yeah. Say up.